Welcome to Majak Innovatsi, the podcast of Unit City dedicated to innovation from Ukraine to the world.
Привет! I am Dominique Piotet. I'm French and American, and after 16 years in Silicon Valley, I decided to move to vibrant and wonderful, but yet mostly unknown tech scene, Kyiv, in Ukraine. I'm the CEO of Unit City, the first Ukrainian smart city dedicated to innovation. And of course, if you want to know more about Unit City, well, you just go online and you type unit.city and you will find us. And well, for this episode of the studio of Majak Innovatsi, we're trying something new because, you know, we cannot go to the studio. I mean, we try to go as much as we can, but this week really we can't. So we try to do a fully Zoom experience, like really. So I'm home. Everybody you're going to hear in this podcast is home. And actually, it's time for me to introduce my two co-hosts, Tatiana Morozova. Tatiana is working in UFuture. UFuture is a holding company that actually owns Unit City and many other amazing venture. And Tatiana is in charge of communication at UFuture. And my friend Andrei Kamarovsky. Andrei is the founder and CEO of SectorX, an accelerator based actually in Unit City. Guys, hello, how are you?
Hey, hey, we're good. Well, hello, given the circumstances.
Oh yeah, glad to hear everyone. Hello.
Majak Innovatsi. 1, 2, 3, launch.
And we, as always, always start with what's cooking. What's cooking in Majak Innovatsi is really what do we have in our kitchen? What's the news? What is interesting? What is intriguing? What's really what? And we're going to start with you, Tatiana. What's cooking in your tech kitchen?
As a big fan of podcasting and radio, I brought some news about podcasting industry. Anchor, a podcasting making application owned by Spotify, will now let you take recordings of your video calls and turn them into podcasts. From now and on, this feature is open for Google Meet, Zoom, Instagram Live, Skype, FaceTime, Twitch. So from now, your weekly Zoom hangouts with your team would be the next hit podcast, as we literally are recording now.
Andre, what's cooking in your kitchen?
Yes. Mine is about VCs this time. In particular, I discovered that one Finnish super early stage VC launches second fund to continue backing pre-founders and pre-seed stage startups. It's called Icebreaker, and it's their second fund that closed at 50 million euros. And this news is really important, in my opinion, in that this fund not only invests in idea stage startups, well, people, founders, basically, but it also works day by day to keep and develop an ever-growing and very tight community of potential founders and co-founders. And these guys believe that the right person at the right time beside you as a potential founder can either make it or break it. And this is, I really think, what we should be thinking about at Unit City, because people is really all that matters at our super early stages.
I love it. That's cool. I totally agree with you. Early stage is key. Actually, I'm going to talk about VC as well. And that's what's been cooking in my kitchen this week. Because, you know, I mean, we just received the numbers from the UVCA, the Ukraine Association of VCs, that is basically all the VC of Ukraine are member. And they just released their annual study on investment in startups. caught up in Ukraine. And let me tell you, 2019 was a good year. I don't know about 2020. It's probably going to be a very different story with the crisis. But still, I mean, really, last year was a good year. Actually, the total volume of venture investment into Ukraine IT company has reached almost $500 million. I mean, a little bit more than $500 million, which is 1.5 more than what we saw in 2018. We saw actually an increase in angel investment, an increase by 7 times in angel investment, mostly in very early stage, compared to 2018, more than $6 million in early stage. And well, of course, we saw also bigger deals, top three biggest deal in terms of gross investment, where GitLab who raised $268 million, Grammarly $90 million, and People AI $60 million. So we start to see really the ground of something that is interesting. Well, also something that I found interesting is the number of women among founders, and actually that woman in that number in Ukraine is higher than the global average, because we have 26% of the companies, startup companies where we've been raising money in Ukraine, that will have a woman as a co-founder, and the global average is only 19%. So 26 versus 19%, I think it's Ukraine is doing something good. Thank you, guys. That was what was cooking in our kitchen this week. And now it's time to go under the spotlight of Mayak.
Mayak Innovacji, shine bright like a unicorn.
This week, under the spotlight of Mayak, we have a guest coming all the way from sunny California. Well, actually, is he coming really all the way? Well, he's coming via Zoom from sunny California. So we are in Kyiv, he's in sunny California, and we're going to talk via Zoom. And to be precise, actually, not just from sunny California, but from a very specific place in sunny California, it's UC Berkeley, one of the best universities in the world, based in Silicon Valley. Well, actually, we could debate that. Is really Berkeley based in Silicon Valley? I don't know. I'm not always sure about this. His name is Rick Rasmussen. He actually graduated from UC Berkeley and also from Columbia University. He's both an engineer and a business guy. He has been an entrepreneur, CEO of companies several times, a VC, and also an academic. He is now an industry fellow and director of the startup program at the Saturja Center for Entrepreneurship and Technology at UC Berkeley College of Engineering. All this gives him a great perspective, but he's very special for us because he's also a friend of Ukraine, where he's actually have been several times, and is an advisor and board member of Unit Factory, the coding school of Unit City. Rick, hello. How are you?
Hello, Dominic. Hello from Silicon Valley.
It's really good to have you. Well, first, before we talk about the bridge between Ukraine and Silicon Valley, how do you discover Ukraine, and how did you become involved in the tech scene of Ukraine? What's the story between you and Ukraine?
That's an interesting question. Thank you for asking. It all came, well, I had a professional career where I was part of three different companies that started from scratch in the semiconductor industry. We built them all to Fortune 500 status. I became a venture capitalist for a little while after that. And then I was semi-retired. My career was looking for some grounding. And I got a call from the Canadian consulate in here in Silicon Valley. I'm not Canadian, but they were looking for somebody with a good network and connections and the ability to kind of understand what companies needed and how to bridge, at that point, Canada to here. So I was an employee of the Canadian government for 3 years, worked in the local consulate in Palo Alto, built a whole series of bridge programs, including something called 48 Hours in the Valley. a Canadian technology accelerator, which was the first international accelerator here in Silicon Valley. It was based at Plug and Play, built an alumni network, and so on. That was really fun. I really enjoyed it at that point in my career. Now, working within government is sometimes a little problematic, a little constricting. So I left full-time employment, but then started to work with countries around the world. So at one point, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Korea, Belarus, Brazil, among others. And along the way there, started to work with startups and entrepreneurs and doing some teaching at Berkeley. So I was in the middle of both teaching as well as, you know, working with international development agencies, if you will. The Ukraine bridge, which is what your question was all about, really happened because there was a delegation led by Vasily that came out in 2018 to do a Silicon Valley tour to explore what was going on. And they visited Stanford and a lot of the accelerators around, and also came by Berkeley, and I was their host. So I got nominated, not knowing a lot about what was going on. And I did some research in advance and took a look at what was happening in the investment community, what was happening with angel networks, what was happening with bridge programs. And I gave sort of a whole report, if you will, to that incoming delegation, which was about 20 people. And I guess it went well, because I was then invited back to Ukraine as a speaker for Kiev, the Kiev International Economic Forum, which happens usually in October. Been a speaker there in October in 2018, 2019, and the relationship has grown ever since. It's been great. I really, really enjoy Ukraine. It is now, I have to say, my favorite country of all the ones that I'm working with.
Ooh, we love hearing that. Andre, do you want to start with a question?
Well, I might. Rick, actually, we met with you like 5 times, and the first time was 8 or 10 years ago. This was my first time when I came to Silicon Valley, when I was working with my own startup studio, Coffee Lab, and then we also met a couple times in the Valley as well. And the last time we met was, I was on that delegation led by Vasily that happened in 2018. So I pretty much know what you're doing, and thank you for that. Thank you for coming over. And yes, my question, do you miss startups? That's a short one.
Do I miss startups? Luckily, I get to work with startups every day. So I get the joy of being nominally part of a startup and not the pain of being within one.
That's a really good answer.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example. So I just got elected to be faculty member at the Alchemist Accelerator. I'm one of their judges in the next round of contests and things like that. And so I get to see best and brightest of some of the startups and help the ones that I have a personal affiliation with.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks.
I have a question related to the crisis. I moved to Silicon Valley in 2004. It was at the end of the tech bubble. So and we talked about it, Rick, about the 2000s, that was really, really bad year for Silicon Valley, and how everything went really cool after 2004 and back again. How is it going in Silicon Valley right now? Is it really bad, or how? What does a crisis look like?
Yeah, first let me just reflect on your statement. So what our discussion was earlier was, you know, we started that recession here. Ground zero was Silicon Valley. And what our discussion was basically, after that nuclear winter, we were able to sow the seeds of some brand new efforts like Y Combinator and Plug and Play and the Sutarja Center, where I'm from, which really all started around 2004, 2005. So it was kind of the golden age, a magic time for innovation here. So let's reflect on what's happening now. Well, first off, we're in the middle of it. We just announced yesterday that 6 counties here, including basically all of Silicon Valley, is now shut down through the end of May. So we have another 5 weeks of this to go through. So most people are still working. Most venture capitalists and angel investors are still taking meetings. So it hasn't slowed down to zero, but it has certainly slowed down quite a bit. We're not engaging in kind of the dialogue that we have. The conferences are shut down or gone virtual. The day-to-day life has slowed down dramatically. I think the pattern of these recessions is that, for at least for Silicon Valley, we get hit pretty hard. You know, the average unemployment in the tech sector will reaches something along the lines of 20%. Somewhere 40, 50% of all the startups end up disappearing just because they aren't able to raise money. But we're used to it. This place is very resilient. Recessions actually are healing in a way, and it gets rid of a lot of the dead wood and a lot of the things that wouldn't necessarily have thrived if they had survived. And those resources get reallocated into things that are more productive in the long run. So usually what happens is there's layoffs that happen in the larger corporations. People either move away, which is fine. Traffic gets better and the housing prices normalize a little bit. But then there's a pool of labor that is searching for employment and often ends up in startups. So startup activity is actually countercyclical. So it rises in the times of a downturn. And the people that gather do so out of necessity, but are very enthusiastic about what it is they're doing. So if you think about, you know, what has emerged out of various recessions, I mean, Google really emerged out of 2001.
Uber, tech. Huh? And then after 2008, the Uber, the
Airbnb, all the shared economy stuff.
Airbnb. Exactly. Yep. 2008. It's interesting because here in Ukraine, I mean, we are also, unfortunately, maybe, but used to crisis. I mean, we had a lot of them and we have a lot of them. And I feel like we're pretty resilient. So do you see a parallel? Do you think it's a good time for a startup in Ukraine?
I think it is. So first off, Ukraine is an amazing talent pool. I mean, you're known globally for that, much of which is dedicated to the outsourcing industry, second to none, just in terms of reputation and the quality of the work that comes out and the way in which you interact with clients and so on. So, you know, that work, I would guess, will probably be slowing down here in the coming months and maybe a year or two. So, from a startup perspective, what that means is you also have a talent pool that can then take a look at doing a more of a classic startup, something that's product or service oriented, as opposed to just simply servicing clients and they're under contract. So I honestly suspect a lot more product companies to come out of Ukraine. And given the fact that we're just going now through a chaotic period, chaos creates opportunities. And those opportunities are there on a global basis. We here in Silicon Valley don't have an exclusive lock on the ability to take advantage of opportunities at a global basis. So given the current state, you have in Ukraine as much, in some cases, if not more, opportunity than we might here. The expense base is lower. The work ethic is, I think, as strong, if not stronger. There's all kinds of things that bode well for Ukraine in the coming months.
Eric, and I would like to ask you, as a big fan of Ukraine, I know that you are praising some industries in Ukraine. And in your opinion, again, aloud, what industries in Ukraine are really attractive to other countries, global markets, besides of commodities, besides of raw materials?
Oh, besides, well, not commodities and raw materials. So I don't deal with that, wheat and, you know, other natural gas and other raw materials like that. No. So from a tech perspective, I mean, I was encouraged by the amount of investment that's starting to flow into Ukraine. That's a really good sign that there's opportunities and the quality of the companies are strong. You don't necessarily, when I deal with different economies around the world, everybody says, oh, we have to have venture capital. We have to have it here. I'm a little bit of, I'm a, I differ in my opinion in that you don't necessarily have to have resident venture capital, domestic venture capitalists investing in domestic industries. What you have to have is strong companies that can attract venture capital, whether it's domestic or coming from international sources. So if you're attracting, you know, GitLab and Grammarly and some of the others, if they're attracting capital from outside, from sources like Europe or the US and so on, that's a really great sign. So, and also if your angel investment network is starting to grow, also good signs. So it's interesting that you open the podcast with those statistics, because I think they're very telling as to what might happen. I agree that 2020 will be a difficult year, but the funds that are strong are still continuing to invest. The opportunities for those funds to invest is good, because typically valuations will drop, so they can pick up bargains. Most of the funds here that have done really well are those that were vintage 2009, 2010, where they were shopping right after the last recession. So I expect a VC investment to remain strong from strong funds. The smaller funds, the ones that are less well-capitalized, the ones without a good set of general partners, will probably end up by the wayside here in the coming months, years. But the cream rises to the top, and I think the top third of VC funds will continue to invest and look for opportunities in places like Ukraine.
That's interesting, because 90%, according to the UVCA study, 90%, 90, of the fund in Ukraine comes from the US.
Wow.
It's kind of interesting. Andre?
Yeah, Rick, do you think that the United States is going to remain as good a market as it used to be for startups, or something might change given your global perspective from the fact that you got to travel a lot? I mean, maybe startups should focus on, I don't know, India, China, Europe, I don't know.
First off, if you take a look at some of the reports like the Startup Genome Report that comes out of the Compass Group and others, you take a look at where the strongest entrepreneurial ecosystems are, and Silicon Valley remains the top, but quickly followed by places like New York and LA, and a little bit farther down the list, Boston and so on. So I think what's happening in the US is that Silicon Valley, which used to have the majority of all the startups, is now still very strong, I believe, and I'll talk about that in a second. But also we're seeing other hubs like New York and LA particularly emerging. So the US, if that's the question, on a national basis, is a good place for startups. Yeah, I think that will continue to be strong. I think we'll continue. I see no reason why we wouldn't necessarily continue to be dominant as the hub. The political climate, the laissez-faire attitude when it comes to individual startups, just the way that we're capitalized and everything else, that's not going away. But I do think that what we're seeing here is that it's no longer singular Silicon Valley, but there's much more of a global growth in entrepreneurship in general. So you're seeing, certainly Europe emerging with London and Paris and others. You're seeing China emerging with Beijing and Shanghai. You're seeing some activity in Latin America, so on. So I think entrepreneurship is much more global than it was 10 years ago.
We're going to take a very short break. It's a classic, it's a tradition now in our show. And for our break, we're going to ask you, Rick, to pick a song, to pick one of your favorite songs that doesn't have to be your favorite. It's just a song that illustrates what we just talked about. And I know you choose one. Which one? And
can you explain why? Oh, God. Well, we're in lockdown here. And so I have the opportunity to go back through some old music and relive some collections. I'm doing that with movies too. But one of my favorite bands is the Talking Heads. They were around during my formative period and continue to play through David Byrne and so on. one of the songs that I particularly like, it's got a great beat, and it's also, in this case, got a great message, is Life During Wartime. And it feels that way. So if you listen to the lyrics, I think you'll find a lot of parallels to what we're going through now.
And we are back with you, Rick. Look, I want to move back to something, or to move to something you do right now for a living. Basically, you teach entrepreneurship. How do you? And I know. I was really interested in seeing that what you do in Berkeley is there's a Berkeley method of entrepreneurship, which is, from what I understand, is a combo of learning by doing and with a very specific focus on mindset. But how do you teach entrepreneurship? I mean, is it possible to teach entrepreneurship?
Of course it is, yeah. What we do is we teach the mindset and the tools. So are you capable of being an entrepreneur? Are you capable of thinking outside the box? You know, we run games, we have reflections, we do all kinds of things to try to get your mind tuned to an open-ended way of thinking. So that's very true. But the tools, I think, are super critical. Before 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people would just simply go into their garage. You have your garage as a background. It's very apropos. Go into a garage, start tinkering around, maybe build something like the early Apple One, try to get to market and so on. But without the background and lessons, everybody was learning on the fly. You'd learn from friends. You'd learn from experience. So what we provide now is that 30 years later is the tools that people can use to maximize success or otherwise minimize failure, if you will. So there's the Steve Blank methodology, which is all about customer development. It's customer discovery. Are you building, and what problems do your customers have? Are you building a solution for them that they think is worthwhile? Then you get into the product market fit, which is trying to identify how are you going to sell your product and what messages. That technique is all about experimentation, almost like the scientific method applied to entrepreneurship. You come up with a hypothesis about how you think your customers are behaving or what you think they need. You design an experiment to test that. You interview them to see whether it's your hypothesis are right or wrong. You then, if it's wrong or you come up with something you didn't expect, you then pivot into things that are new. And you can run these experiments quickly, cheaply, easily, and get closer towards potential success than you otherwise might. So that makes it, this whole experimentation methodology can easily be taught. We send our students out into the world, have them interview potential customers, come back with results, and actually build startups along the way. So we put our students through customer discovery, customer validation, customer creation, have them build a full financial plan, and then present that to venture capitalists at the end. And this journey can be done in a number of different ways. It can be done either, hey, just come up with a company that you think might work, or you can do it around a theme. So we have classes that do themes around blockchain or around cybersecurity, or around biology-based companies like plant-based meats or something like that. And so they're learning both how to be entrepreneurs, but they're also learning the vertical expertise in that particular field. So we've been doing this for a while now, and it's proven to be very successful. We're getting a lot of spin-outs. Berkeley's now passed Stanford as the number one producer of startups out of any university in the world. So,
yeah. Do you think it's universal? Like, can you apply the same tools and mindset approach anywhere in the world? And I mean, of course, in Ukraine as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's nothing unique about the classroom environment and sending people out for doing interviews and things like that. Variants of this are actually being taught around the world at this point. And I teach this methodology annually in Abu Dhabi, in Austria, in Korea. So I go off when I'm not teaching here to other locations around the world and run seminars that can last anywhere from a week to a month. And that's really intensive, and we run them through that entire process.
I want to ask Rick about the mentality of Ukrainian entrepreneurs. Are Ukrainian entrepreneurs closer to the West or to the East by mentality, or maybe in between? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely the West. I mean, the East, I'll take China as an example, which is not, I mean, it is the East, but I'll do it just because it's so different. You know, from there, it is a top-down methodology, a top-down society. Government is all-knowing, all-seeing, all-wise, and basically you try to conform with what government is asking of you, and you march forward. So, in general, while the Chinese are very entrepreneurial, they don't necessarily make great entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurship is more of a grassroots, do it yourself. You have the passion. You really believe that you're going to drive things forward. It's much more organic in terms of its development without necessarily government telling you what to do or how to do it. I see Ukrainians acting exactly that way. It's super entrepreneurial. Everybody that I speak with has got that spirit. The culture itself, I'd say, out of almost all the places that I visit, is amongst the top in terms of the propensity to be entrepreneurial. In a lot of places like Korea, I have to undo culture a little bit. I have to get people to challenge me in the classroom and to be able to get out and interview people and talk to people and get their opinions and argue with them. Ukrainians do all that naturally.
Well, I do talk a lot about entrepreneurship and how to become one with my fellow co-founders and entrepreneurs. And the question I want to ask is, Rick, you said that entrepreneurship is kind of a combination of desire and to build something, to develop something, and a toolbox, the right toolbox. Can we apply this combination to virtually any person out there, given the right culture and grow a good entrepreneur? Or does it take more than just that to be Larry Page or, you know, Travis Kalanick?
Yeah. So people that take our classes, I can say about a third of them go through and afterwards say to themselves, entrepreneurship is not necessarily for me. They're not comfortable with the uncertainty that you go through. They prefer things that are more structured. They're more operational, I think, in their mentality. That's totally fine. That's a perfectly fine outcome, because in a classroom environment, you can try something. And if you don't necessarily want to pursue it, that's great. You know, we all take math and chemistry. Not everybody becomes a mathematician or a chemist. About a third don't pursue it in any different given way. About half then go into the corporate environment, work for a large company, but they still have the tools, entrepreneurial tools, to exercise that capability within a larger corporation. So they might be part of a new product division, example being, or start a new initiative, but they can be entrepreneurial within a larger environment. And then some of them, and it's a minority, it's a small minority, actually then go off and do their own startups directly right out of school. So we do see a whole span. There are psychological tests, and I'll give a little commercial here. There's something called the Berkeley Innovation Index. You can take a look at it, berkeleyinnovationindex.org. And it measures your propensity to be entrepreneurial along 7 different dimensions. It's cool. I recommend everybody take it. It's free. It's just kind of fun.
Rick, is that something the Founder Institute program uses in its batches, in its cohorts?
Yeah, of course. So we take the entrepreneurial temperature of students as they come into the program, into a class. measure them, have them measure, and it takes about 10, 15 minutes max to their propensity right from day one. And then we have them retake it at the end of the class and see if we've been able to shift their mindset or mentality at all. And in almost all cases, yes, that's the case.
Yeah, and I have to admit that this evaluation really works because we used it and it proved to produce really good results. It does.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you.
What is the website again? And we will share with of course the people who are listening to us.
Sure. BerkeleyInnovationIndex.org.
BerkeleyInnovationIndex.org. Tatiana, do you have a question for Rick?
Yes, I would like to prolong discussion about this crisis. And Rick, how do you think entrepreneurship, how would it change after this crisis, in this crisis? Maybe we will get new skills after that.
Well, certainly we're getting sort of survival skills. Not that this is, you know, life-threatening, but I think everybody is learning how to be, how to adapt to different circumstances. The first initial outcome, I believe, will be startups that take a look at opportunities that come out of crisis like this. You know, I think we'll see the number of healthcare startups emerge greatly. I think we'll see startups that deal with home offices and this different sort of work style that we're going through, which will last. There will be resurgences of viruses, if not this one, then others, and so on. So there's got a lot of opportunity there. So two things. One is your own personal adaptability, and then separately, whatever opportunities emerge out of the circumstances that we're going through. It's funny. So what we're seeing here too is the reemergence of hackathons. So hackathons here died about 5 years ago. We don't really run them. They're fun. They're a good learning tool for high schoolers and people that have never coded before. But as useful entrepreneurial tools, they've got set aside in favor of other things like, you know, formal classes and so on. They've reemerged. So there's tons of COVID-19 hackathons happening everywhere. Almost every organization has got something, and people are really trying to come up with quick fix solutions rapidly. So it talks to the entrepreneurial spirit and the fact that there's a lot of energy in trying to fix this particular problem or make life better around what's going on now.
We have those in Ukraine as well, and actually Unit City is supporting a few of them. Well, thank you very much, Rick. We could keep going. We can't wait to have you coming back to Ukraine. So hopefully this will happen before the end of the year, but we will see. But now it's going to be a wrap. And before we completely wrap, our tradition is to ask our guest to share one of his heroes. So do you have any hero, Rick? And who could that be?
I do. It's not a contemporary hero. A lot of people will point to somebody that they know or somebody in the news. I think it's a little tough, particularly in America right now. We're not at our best, I'd say, at this point, politically. Economically, yes, but politically, maybe not. While all of this is going on, I continually am amazed at the framers of the Constitution of the United States. You know, the three-tiered system, legislative, executive branch, judicial branch, the balance of powers, everything that's going on. And it has been under a tremendous challenge over the last 3 years or so, even more. And that document, the framers of it, just put it together, and it's amazing. So hats off to Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton and Franklin and Washington and all the people that helped put that together. I mean, truly heroes here, you know, 250 years later. I think it's great.
Andre, how do you want to wrap this up?
I just want to say to everybody who's listening us right now that guys, girls, ladies and gentlemen, just do not waste your time on quarantine. Do something worthy, learn something, good and practical and develop yourself, this thing is definitely going to end sooner or later. But in what shape you emerge out of it will define your future. And the steps you guys take right here, right now, will define who you will be after the quarantine.
Tatiana, how do you want to wrap this up?
As I feel, despite this lockdown and distance, we are pretty close and nothing can stop us. We have no limits in this communication. We can discuss wherever everything. And I'm sure that Rick Rasmussen will grab the first ticket once the sky will be open, straight to Kyiv, and we will greet him here and we'll listen to his new theory and new hints how to be a brilliant entrepreneur. Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure. This has been great.
And we can't wait to have you back. It is the end of this podcast. Don't forget to like, to share, to comment. Please stay safe, stay curious, and stay passionate. Diakou, and see you very soon, cupcakes.